Chapter 7. His Excellency, the Governor of La Réunion, sat at the head of his council table. He now wore a uniform as splendid as that of the gold and scarlet colonels on his left hand, more splendid by far than the weather-worn blue of the sea officers on his right, and now there was no question of his sitting mute. Yet there was no trace of hauteur to be seen on his eager, intelligent face as he tried to guide the meeting towards a unanimous approval of the Commodore's revolutionary scheme, his plan of an instant attack upon Mauritius, with simultaneous landings from Flat Island off Port Louis and in the neighbourhood of Port Southeast at the other end of the island. Colonel Keating had been with him from the first, but a distinct inclination to enjoy the fruits of victory for a while, to allow the men a little rest, and more creditably a desire to prepare the campaign with due deliberation, so that mortars, for example, didn't arrive without their shells, had yet to be overcome. For if so ambitious and risky an operation as this were to fail, the attempt could be justified only by a unanimous vote. "I shall echo the Commodore's words, gentlemen," said Mr. Farquhar, "and cry, lose not a moment. This is the moment at which we have a superiority of 5-3 in frigates, when we possess a fleet of transports, troops in the first flush of victory, and exact intelligence of the enemy's strength and dispositions on the Mauritius, supplied by their own records here."
Hear him, said Colonel Keating.
"With command of the sea, we may concentrate our forces wherever we choose. Furthermore, my colleague," bowing to Stephen at the far end of the table, "assures me that at this juncture, this very favourable juncture, our efforts at sapping the enemy's morale are more than likely to be crowned with success, and we're all aware of Dr. Maturin's powers in that direction." It was not the most fortunate stroke. Some of the colonels, who had toiled and sweated extremely in the hope of glory, turned a sombre gaze upon Dr. Maturin. Feeling this, Mr. Farquhar hurried on. "And perhaps even more important, this is the moment at which our hands are free. The Leopard has taken our dispatches to the Cape. She will not return. No orders from any authority unacquainted with the exact state of local conditions can take the guidance of operations from the hands of those who are acquainted with them. No new set of staff officers can, for the moment, arrive with a plan of campaign matured in Bombay, Fort William, or Whitehall. This is a state of affairs that cannot last."
"Hear him! Hear him!"
said Colonel Keating, Colonel MacLeod, and Colonel Fraser. And the fatter, more cautious staff officers exchanged uneasy glances. "Far be it from me to decry patient, laborious staff work," said the Governor. "We've seen its gratifying results on this island. But, gentlemen, time and tide wait for no man, and I must remind you that fortune is bald behind." Walking away from the residence through streets placarded with the Governor's proclamation, Jack said to Stephen, "What is this that Farquhar tells us about fortune? Is she supposed to have the mange?" They conceive he was referring to the old tag. His meaning was that she must be seized by the forelock, since once she is passed there is no clapping onto her hair at all. In the figure she ships none abaft the ears, if you follow me.
Oh, I see. Rather well put. Though I doubt those heavy-sided lobsters will smoke the simile.
He paused, considering, and said, "It don't sound very eligible, bald behind. But, however, it's all figurative, all figurative." He gazed with benign approval at a strikingly elegant woman, accompanied by an even more willowy black slave girl, stepped into the gutter to let them pass. They looked haughty, unconscious, 1,000 miles away, and continued, Still, I'm glad they've come to see reason. But, Lord Stephen, what an infernal waste of time these councils are. If it had dragged on another day, the squadron would have been dispersed. Sirius is gone already, and I should have had to follow my own scheme. My first duty is to the sea, and I must get at Amelin before the Bellone and Minerva are back. But as it is, I can combine the two. Pullings! He exclaimed. On the other side of the street, Pullings cast off the girl at his side and crossed, blushing a reddish mahogany, yet beaming too. "Did you find anything you liked, Pullings?" asked Jack. "I mean, in the professional line." "Oh, yes, sir. I was only looking after her for a minute, for another officer, sir. But I don't suppose you'll let me have her, sir. Far too pretty, except for a trifle of worm in her futtocks, her grand futtocks." Pullings had been sent to St. Paul's in the Sirius when the frigate tore down immediately after the capitulation to snap up all the shipping in the road. He'd been told to make his own choice of a replacement for the Groper, and he'd done himself as proud as Pontius Pilate. They watched the young woman attach herself to the arm of Mr. Joyce of the kite transport, and as they walked along, Pullings, more coherent now that he was relieved of a sense of guilt, for very strangely his officers looked upon Jack Aubrey as a moral figure, in spite of all proofs to the contrary, expatiated on the merits of his prize, a privateer schooner, copper-fastened, wonderfully well-found. At the gates of the government stable-yard they parted, and while Bondon led forth a powerful black horse, once the pride of the French garrison, Stephen said, "This is not the moment to ask how you mean to combine the two schemes. Yet I admit that I am curious to know. Bondon, I advise you, in your own best interest, not to stand behind that creature's heels." "If you ride over to St. Paul's with me," said Jack, "I'll tell you. Alas, I have an audience with the bishop in half an hour, and then an appointment at the printing shop." "Maybe it's just as well. Things will be clearer in the morning. Bondon, cast off afore." Things were indeed clearer in the morning. The Commodore had seen all the officers concerned. He had all the facts distinctly arranged, and he received Stephen in a room filled with charts and maps. "Here, do you see," he said, pointing to an island 3 or 4 miles off port southeast, "is the Ile de la Passe. It lies on the reef at the very edge of the only deep-water channel into the port. A devilish channel, narrow, with a double dogleg and any number of banks and rocks in its bed. The island's pretty strongly held. It mounts about 20 heavy guns, but the town is not. They expect us in the north, where we've been blockading all this while, and most of their forces are around poor Louis. So, if we knock out the Ile de la Passe, and a couple of frigates should be able to manage it, in spite of the intricate navigation. These are very alarming shoals, brother. I see 2 and 3 fathoms marked for a couple of miles inside the reef, and here is a vast area with the words canoe passage at high tide. While your channel's a mere serpent, a lean serpent at the best, but I'm not to be teaching you your business." "It can be done. Clonfert and his black pilot know these waters perfectly. Look, here's the Jacate anchorage just at hand where he cut out the American. Yes, they should manage it well enough. Though, of course, it must be done by boats and in the night. Ships couldn't stand in against that fire without being sadly mauled. Then, once the island is seized, the French can't easily retake it. Their batteries can't reach across the inner bay, and since they have no ship of force in port southeast, nor even gunboats, they have no means of getting their artillery any nearer. Nor can they starve it out so long as we victual it from the sea. So, if we hold the Ile de la Passe, we deny the French their best harbour after Port Louis. We have a base for our landing, and we open up all the country out of range of the batteries for your handing out of broadsheets and culling simples. For their little garrisons in the town and along the coast will scarcely stir outside the reach of their own guns.
This is a very beautiful plan, said Stephen.
Ain't it? Said Jack.
Keating's already sent some Bombay gunners and European troops into the Nereid to garrison the place when we've taken it. For obviously the Nereid possesses more local knowledge than all the rest of the squadron put together.
You don't feel that Clonfert's oversetting of the little ship off the Riviere de Pluie throws a certain shade on his qualifications?
No, I do not. It could have happened to anyone in those circumstances, with the soldiers ready to call us shy. I should have tried it myself. But I'm not going to give him his head at the Ile de la Passe. I don't want him to be coming at the Cochrane. Pym shall command. Pym may not be very wise, but he's a good, sound man, as regular as a clock. So, Nereid, Iphigenia, and perhaps Staunch.
What is the Staunch?
She's a brig. Came in last night from Bombay. A useful little brig, and in excellent order. Narborough has her. A most officer-like cove. You remember Narborough, Stephen? Stephen shook his head. Of course you do, cried Jack. Lord Narborough. A big black man with a Newfoundland dog, third of the surprise.
You mean Garum, said Stephen.
Garum, of course, you're quite right. Garum he was then, but his father died last year, and now he's called Narborough. So, Nereid, Iphigenia, and perhaps Staunch, if she can get her water in quick enough, are to run up to Port Louis, where Pym is watching Amelin's motions. Iphigenia will stay, and Sirius and Nereid will come south for the Ile de la Passe.
The Nereid is not to come back here, so?
To wait for the dark of the moon, you mean? No, we can't afford the time.
Then in that case, I'd better go aboard her now. There's a great deal to be done in the Mauritius, and the sooner I get there, the better. For I tell you, my dear, that though they are less lethal, my broadsheets are as effective as your round shot.
Stephen, said Jack, I am convinced of it.
I had almost said as effective as your broadsides, but I was afraid the miserable play upon words might offend an embryonic baronet. For Farquhar tells me that if this second campaign should succeed as well as the first, the happy commander will certainly be so honoured. Should you not like to be a baronet, Jack?
Why, as to that, said Jack, I don't know that I should much care for it. The Jack Aubrey of King James's time paid a thumping fine not to be a baronet, you know. Not that I mean the least fling against men who've won a great fleet action. It's right and proper that they should be peers. But when you look at the mass of titles, tradesmen, dirty politicians, moneylenders, why, I'd as soon be plain Jack Aubrey, Captain Jack Aubrey, for I'm as proud as Nebuchadnezzar of my service rank, and if ever I hoist my flag, I shall paint Here Lives Admiral Aubrey on the front of Ashgrove Cottage in huge letters. Don't think I'm one of your wild democratical Jacobins, Stephen. Don't run away with that notion, but different people look at these things in different lights.
He paused and said with a grin, I'll tell you one chap who'd give his eye teeth to be a baronet, and this is Admiral Bertie. He puts it down to Mrs. Bertie, but the whole service knows how he plotted and planned for the bath.
Lord, he said, laughing heartily, to think of crawling about St. James's for a ribbon when you're an ancient man past 60. Though, to be sure, perhaps I might think differently if I had a son, but I doubt it.
In the afternoon of the next day, Dr. Maturin, preceded by two bales of handbills, proclamations and broadsheets, some printed in Cape Town, and others so recently struck off in Saint-Denis that they were still damp from the press, came alongside the Nereid 6 hours late. But the Nereids weren't used to his ways.
They were in a fuming hurry to be off in pursuit of the Iphigenia, which had sailed at crack of dawn, and they let him drop between the boat and the ship's side. In his fall, he struck his head and back on the boat's gunwale, cracking two ribs and sinking, stunned, down through the warm, clear water. The frigate was already underway, and although she heaved to at once, not a man aboard did anything more valuable than run about shouting for some minutes, and by the time she'd dropped her sternboat, Stephen would have been dead if one of the bale-carrying black men hadn't dived in and fetched him out. He'd had a shrewd knock, and although the weather was so kind, the sun so warm, an inflammation of the lungs kept him pinned to his cot for days. Or rather, to the captain's cot, for Lord Clomford moved from his own sleeping cabin and slung a hammock in the coach. Stephen, therefore, missed their rapid voyage north, the meeting of the ships off Port Louis, and their return southwards through heavy seas to carry out the Commodore's plan of attack on the Ile de la Paz. He missed all but the sounds of their first abortive attempt at gathering the boats for the assault in a pitch-black night with the wind blowing a close-reefed topsail gale, when even the Nereid's pilot couldn't find the channel, and when the weather forced them back to Port Louis. But, on the other hand, in the circumstances of particular intimacy, he did grow more closely acquainted with Clomford and MacAdam. The captain spent many hours at Stephen's bedside. Their conversation was desultory and for most part of no great consequence, but Clomford was capable of an almost female delicacy. He could be quiet without constraint, and he always knew when Stephen would like a cooling drink or the skylight opened, and they talked about novels, the more recent romantic poetry, and Jack Aubrey, or rather Jack Aubrey's actions, in a most companionable way. And at times Stephen saw, among the various persons that made up his host, a gentle, vulnerable creature, one that excited his affection. His intuition, however, reflected Stephen, though so nice in a tête-à-tête, doesn't serve him when three or more are gathered in a room, nor when he is anxious. Jack has never seen him in his quasi-domestic character. His women have, no doubt. And it may be this that accounts for his notorious success among them. These reflections were prompted by the visit of his old shipmate, Narborough, before whom Clomford pranced away, monopolising the talk with anecdotes of Sir Sidney Smith, and to whom he behaved with such an aggressive affectation of superiority that the commander of the Staunch soon returned aboard her, thoroughly displeased. Yet that same evening, as the Nereid and Staunch approached the Ile de la Paz once more, coming south, about while the Sirius took the northern route to avoid suspicion, Clonfert was as quiet and agreeable and well-bred as ever he had been. Particularly conciliating, indeed, as though he were aware of his lapse. And when, at his request, Stephen had once again related Jack's taking of the Cacafuego, shot by shot, Clonfert said with a sigh, "Well, I honour him for it, upon my word. I should die happy with such a victory behind me." With MacAdam, Stephen's relationship was by no means so pleasant. Like most medical men, Stephen was an indifferent patient, and like most medical men, MacAdam had an authoritative attitude towards those under his care. As soon as the patient had recovered his wits, they fell out over the advisability of a cingulum, a black draught, and phlebotomy, all of which Stephen rejected in a weak, hoarse, but passionate voice as utterly explored, fit for Paracelsus, or a quicksilver at the fair of Ballinasloe, together with a fling about MacAdam's fondness for a straight waistcoat. Yet this, even when it was coupled with Stephen's recovery without any treatment but bark administered by himself, wouldn't have caused real animosity if MacAdam had not also taken to resenting Clomfort's attention to Stephen, Stephen's ascendancy over Clonfert, and their pleasure in one another's company. He came into the cabin, only half drunk, the evening before the Nereid and the Staunch, though delayed by headwinds, hoped to rendezvous with Sirius off the Ile de la Passe for the assault, took Stephen's pulse, said, "There's still a wee smidgen of fever that bleeding would certainly have cured before this, but I shall allow you to take the hour on deck again tomorrow if the action leaves you any deck to take it upon." Drew his case bottle from his pocket, poured himself a liberal dram in Stephen's physic glass, and bending, picked up a paper that had slipped beneath the cot, a single printed sheet. "What language is this?" he asked, holding it to the light. "It's Irish," said Stephen calmly. He was extremely vexed with himself for letting it be seen, for although there was no kind of remaining secrecy about his activities, his ingrained sense of caution was deeply wounded. He was determined not to let this appear, however. "'Tis not the Irish character," said MacAdam. "Irish type is rarely to be found in the French colonies, I believe."
"I suppose it's meant for those papish blackguards on the Mauritius," said MacAdam, referring to the Irishman who had known to have enlisted in the French service. Stephen made no reply, and MacAdam went on. "What does it say?"
"Do you not understand Irish?"
"Of course not. What would a civilized man want with Irish?"
"Perhaps that depends upon your idea of a civilized man."
"I'll just give you my idea of a civilized man. It's one that makes croppies lie down, that drinks to King Billy, and that cries, 'Fuck the Pope!'"
With this, MacAdam began to sing, "Croppies Lie Down," and the grating, triumphant noise wounded Stephen's still fevered and over-acute hearing. Stephen was fairly sure that MacAdam didn't know he was a Catholic, but even so his irritation, increased by the heat, the din, the smell, and his present inability to smoke, rose to such a pitch that against all his principles he said, "It is the pity of the world, Dr. MacAdam, to see a man of your parts obnubilate his mind with the juice of the grape." MacAdam instantly collected his faculties and replied, "It is the pity of the world, Dr. Machelin, to see a man of your parts obnubilate his mind with the juice of the poppy." In his journal that night, Stephen wrote, "And his blotched face clearing on a sudden, he checked me with my laudanum. I am amazed at his perspicacity. Yet do I indeed obnubilate my mind? Surely not. Looking back in this very book, I detect no diminution of activity, mental or physical. The pamphlet on Bonaparte's real conduct towards this Pope of the last is as good as anything I've ever written. I wish it may be as well translated. I rarely take 1,000 drops, a trifle compared with your true opium eater's dose, or with my own in Diana's day. I can refrain whenever I choose, and I take it only when my disgust is so great that it threatens to impede my work. One day, when he's sober, I shall ask MacAdam whether disgust for oneself, for one's fellows, and for the whole process of living was common among his patients in Belfast, whether it incapacitated them. My own seems to grow. And it is perhaps significant that I can feel no gratitude towards the man who took me from the water and make the gestures that humanity requires, but I feel no real kindness for him. Surely this is inhuman. Humanity drained away by disgust. It grows. And although my loathing for Bonaparte and his evil system is an efficient stimulant, hatred alone is a poor, sterile kind of a basis. And laudanum or not, the disgust seems to persist even through my sleep, since frequently it is there, ready to envelop me when I wake. The next morning was not one of these occasions, frequent though they were. Having listened in vain at intervals throughout the night for sounds that might herald an action or even a meeting with the other ships, Stephen awoke from a long, comfortable, dozing state, a wholly relaxed well-being, aware that his fever was gone and that he was being looked at through the crack of the partly open door. "Hola!" he cried. And a nervous midshipman, opening wider, said, "The captain's compliments to Dr. Maturin, and should he be awakened well enough, there's a mermaid on the starboard bow." She was abaft the beam before Stephen reached the rail. A vast, greyish creature with a round snout and thick lips upright in the sea, staring at the ship with her minute, beady eyes. If she was indeed a maid, then she must have had a friend who was none, for in her left flipper she held a huge grey baby. She was going fast astern, staring steadily, but he had time to see her opulent bosom, her absence of neck, hair and external ears, and to estimate her weight at 40 stone, before she dived, showing her broad tail above the wave. He made the fullest acknowledgments for such a treat, had always longed to see one, had searched the Rodriguez lagoons and those of an island near Sumatra, but had always been disappointed until this happy moment, and now he found the realization of his wishes even more gratifying than he had hoped. "I'm glad you was pleased," said Lord Clonfert, "and I hope it may be some lay-off against my wretched news. Sirius has queered our pitch. See where she lays?" Stephen took his bearings. 4 or 5 miles away, on his right hand, rose the southeast coast of Mauritius, with the Pointe du Diable running into the sea. Also on his right hand, but within 100 yards, the long reef stretched out fore and aft, sometimes dry, sometimes buried under the white rollers, with the occasional island standing on it or rising from the paler, shallow water inside. And at the far end, where Clonfert was pointing, there lay the Sirius, close to a fortified island from whose walls, clear in the telescope, flew the Union Jack. In spite of his pleasure at Stephen's delight, it was clear that Clonfert was profoundly disappointed and put out. "They must have gained 20 leagues on us while we were beating up off the Cape," he said. "But if Pym had any bowels, he would have waited for tonight. After all, I did lend him my pilot." However, as an attentive host, he checked any bitter reflections that might have occurred to him, and asked Stephen whether he would like his breakfast. "You're very good, my lord," said Stephen, "but I believe I shall stay here in the hope of seeing another siren. They are usually found in the shallow water by a reef, I'm told, and I shouldn't miss one for a dozen breakfasts." "Clarges will bring it to you here, if you're quite sure you're strong enough," said Clonfert. "But I must send for MacAdam to survey you first." MacAdam looked singularly unappetizing in the morning light, ill-conditioned and surly. Apprehensive, too, for he had some confused recollection of harsh words having passed the night before. But having beheld the mermaid, Stephen was in charity with all men, and he called out, "You missed the mermaid, my dear colleague, but perhaps if we sit quietly here we may see another." "I did not," said MacAdam. "I saw the brute out of the quarter-gallery scuttle, and it was only a manatee." Stephen mused for a while, and then he said, "A dugong, surely. The dentition of the dugong is quite distinct from that of the manatee. The manatee, as I recall, has no incisors. Furthermore, the whole breadth of Africa separates their respective realms." "Manatee or dugong, 'tis odd one," said MacAdam. "As far as my studies are concerned, the brute is of consequence only in that it is the perfect illustration of the strength, the irresistible strength of suggestion. Have you been listening to their gab down there in the waist?" "Not I," said Stephen. There had been much talk among the men working just out of sight forward of the quarter-deck rail, cross, contentious talk. But the Nereid was always a surprisingly chatty ship, and apart from putting this outburst down to vexation at their late arrival, he hadn't attended to it. "They seem displeased, however," he added.
"Of course they're displeased. Everyone knows the ill luck a mermaid brings. But that's not the point. Listen now, will you? That is John Matthews, a truthful, sober, well-judging man. And the other is Old Lemon, was bred a lawyer's clerk, and understands evidence."
Stephen listened, sorted out the voices, caught the thread of the argument. The dispute between Matthews and Lemon, the spokesman of two rival factions, turned upon the question of whether the mermaid had held a comb in her hand or a glass.
"They saw the flash of that wet flipper," said MacAdam, "and have translated it with total gospel oath conviction into one or other of these objects. Matthews offers to fight Lemon and any two of his followers over a chest in support of his belief."
"Men have gone to the stake for less," said Stephen. And walking forward to the rail, he called down, "You're both of you out entirely. It was a hairbrush." Dead silence in the waist. The seamen looked at one another doubtfully, and moved quietly away among the boats on the booms with many a backward glance, thoroughly disturbed by this new element.
"Sirius signalling, sir, if you please," said a midshipman to the officer of the watch, who had been picking his teeth with a pertinacity so great that it had rendered him deaf to the dispute. "Captain to come aboard."
"I'm anxious to see whether the Sirius has any prisoners," said Stephen when the captain appeared. "And if I may, I will accompany you." Pym welcomed them with less than his usual cheerfulness. It had been a bloody little action, one in which he'd lost a young cousin. And although the frigate's decks were now as trim as though she were lying at St. Helens, there was a row of hammocks awaiting burial at sea, while her boats still lay about her in disorder, all more or less battered, and one with a dismounted carronade lying in a red pool. The anxiety of the night had told on Pym, and now that the stimulus of victory was dying, he looked very tired. Furthermore, the Iphigenia had sent an aviso with word that the three frigates in Port Louis were ready for sea, and the Sirius was extremely busy preparing her return. Her captain found time to be affable to Stephen, but his preoccupation made his words to Clomfort seem particularly curt and official. When Clomfort, having offered his congratulations, began to say that the Nereid felt she might have been allowed to take part, Pym cut him short. "I really can't go into all that now. First come, first served is the rule in these matters. Here are the French commandant's signals. He didn't have time to destroy them. As for your orders, they're very simple. You will garrison the island with a suitable force." The French had about 100 men and 2 officers. "And hold it until you receive further instructions. And in the meantime, you will carry out such operations ashore as seem appropriate after consultation with Dr. Maturin, whose advice is to be followed in all political matters. Doctor, if you choose to see the French commandant, my dining cabin is at your disposition." When Stephen returned after questioning poor Captain Duvalier, he gained the impression that Clonfert had been rebuked for his tardiness, or for some professional fault to do with the Nereid sailing, and this impression was strengthened as they pulled back in the barge together with the black Mauritian pilot. For Clonfert was silent, his handsome face ugly with resentment. Yet Clonfert's moods were as changeable as a weather glass. And very shortly after the Sirius and Staunch had vanished over the western horizon, with Pym flying back to blockade the French frigates in Port Louis, he blossomed out in a fine flow of spirits. They'd cleared up the bloody mess in the fort, blasting holes in the coral rock for the dead soldiers. They'd installed the Bombay gunners and 50 grenadiers of the 69th, reordering the heavy guns so that one battery commanded the narrow channel and the other all the inner anchorage that was within their range. They had taken the Nereid through the narrow channel into a snug berth behind the fort, and now he was a free man, his own master, with the whole of the nearby coast upon which to distinguish himself. No doubt he was directed to advise with Dr. Maturin, but Dr. Maturin, having required him to harangue the men on the absolute necessity for good relations with all civilians, black or white, male or female, was quite happy to fall in with his military views, such as an assault upon the battery on the Pointe Diable, and indeed upon any other batteries that might catch his fancy. Dr. Maturin's attitude towards these forays was so far remote from the killjoy disapproval Clomfort had at one time feared that he even accompanied the flotilla which crossed the wide lagoon by night to carry the Pointe du Diable in great style at dawn without the loss of a man. He watched the destruction of the guns, the carrying off of a beautiful brass mortar, and the prodigious jet of fire as the powder magazine blew up with evident complacency, and then walked off into the country to make a variety of contacts and to spread his subversive literature. Day after day the raids on military installations continued. In spite of the opposition of the French regulars and of the far more numerous militia, for the French had no cavalry, and boats guided by a pilot who knew every creek and passage could reach their goal far sooner than the infantry. Moreover, as Stephen's printed sheets attained a wider circulation, it became apparent that the militia was growing less and less inclined to fight. In fact, after about a week in which the Nereids had traversed the country in all directions, doing no harm to private property, paying for whatever they needed, treating the private Mauritians civilly, and routing all the meagre troops that the southern commander could bring against them, the attitude of the militia came more to resemble a neutrality, and a benevolent neutrality at that. Day after day the soldiers, marines and seamen went ashore. The frigate grew steadily more infested with monkeys and parrots, bought in the villages or captured in the woods. And Stephen, though busy with his own warfare, had an interview with an ancient gentlewoman whose grandfather had not only seen run down and devoured a dodo, perhaps the last dodo to tread the earth, but had stuffed a bolster with its feathers. Although there was no loot, this was a pleasant interval for all hands, with plenty of excitement and charming weather, to say nothing of fresh fruit, fresh vegetables, fresh meat and soft tack. Yet Clomfort Exultant was a less agreeable companion than Clomfort Oppressed. Stephen found his boisterous energy wearisome, his appetite for destruction distasteful, and his continual dashing about the country, often in full dress, with his diamond-hilted sword and his foolish star, as tedious as the dinners he gave to celebrate the sometimes important, sometimes trivial conquests of his little force. They were conquests in which Stephen could detect no coherent plan. To him they seemed no more than a series of raids determined by the whim of the day. Though, on the other hand, their want of logical sequence puzzled the French commander extremely. These feasts were attended by Clomfort's officers. And once again Stephen noted the curiously vulgar tone of the Nereid's gunroom and midshipman's berth, the open flattery of the captain, and the captain's appetite for this flattery, however gross. Not a dinner passed without Weber, the second lieutenant, comparing Clomfort with Cochrane to Clomfort's advantage. The word dashing was in daily use. And once the purser, with a sideways look at Stephen, offered a comparison with Commodore Aubrey. A comparison that Clonfert, with an affectation of modesty, declined to allow. Stephen also observed that when McAdam was invited, which was not always the case, he was encouraged to drink and then openly derided. It grieved him to see a grey-haired man so used by young fellows who, whatever their seamanship and courage might be, and there was little doubt of either, could make no claim to any intellectual powers, nor yet to common good breeding. And he found it still more painful to see that Clonfert never checked their merriment. The captain seemed more concerned with gaining the approval, even the worship, of his young men than with protecting an old, diminished friend. It was in the mornings that Stephen found Clonfert's boisterousness more than usually tiresome, and he particularly regretted his company one forenoon when, in an interval between political activities, he was negotiating with his old lady for the bolster. Clonfert spoke quite good French, and he meant to help, but he hit a false note from the beginning. His noisy facetiousness offended and confused her. She began to show signs of incomprehension and alarm, and to repeat that one never slept so well as upon Dodo. Sleep was the greatest blessing that God sent to the old. The gentlemen were young and could do very well on booby down. Stephen had almost abandoned hope when Clonfert was called away. But once he was out of the room, she reconsidered his argument, and he was paying down the price when the door burst open. A voice shouted, "Run! Run for the boats! The enemy's in sight!" And the village was filled with pounding feet. He laid down the last broad piece, caught the bolster to his bosom, and joined the rout. Far out at sea to windward, five ships were standing in towards the Ile de la Passe. Steadying himself in the gig with his spyglass to his eye, Clonfert read them off. Victor, the corvette, leading. Then their big frigate, the Minerve. I can't make out the next. Then, by God, the balloon. I could almost swear the last is the Windham Indiaman again. Stretch out there, pull strong. The gig's crew pulled strong. So strong they left the two other boats that had been launched far behind. Three more in the farther creek had not yet even gathered their men. But it was a long, long pull, the whole length of the two spreading anchorages between the shore and the island, 4 miles and more against the wind. "I shall lure them in," said Clonfert to Stephen. And then, having glanced impatiently back towards the distant boats, he added, "Besides, if they go round to poor Louis, Sirius and Iphigenia will be no match for them, with Amelin bringing his three frigates out." Stephen made no reply. The exhausted crew ran the gig alongside the Nereide. Clonfert told the coxswain to stay there and ran aboard. A few moments later, the frigate displayed a French ensign and pendant, and Clonfert dropped down into the boat, crying, "The fort! And stretch out for all you're worth!" Now the fort, too, showed French colours. And after a short pause, the French signal ran up the flagstaff on the island, "Enemy cruising north of Port Louis." The leading frigate replied with the French private signal. The island answered it correctly, and each ship made her number. Clonfert had been right. Victor, Minerve, Bellone. And the two others were Indiamen, outward-bound Indiamen taken in the Mozambique Channel, the Ceylon, and the unlucky Windham again. On nearing the reef, the French squadron reduced sail. It was clear that they were coming in, but they were coming slowly now, and there'd be time to make ready for them. Stephen chose a high, remote corner of the fort from which he could survey the whole scene, and sat there on his bolster. Above him, the white trade clouds passed steadily over the pure sky. In the warm sunlight, the breeze cooled his cheek, and overhead a bosun bird wheeled in perfect curves. But within the ramparts below, he saw far more confusion than he'd expected. Aboard the Nereide, which had warped in closer to the island, and which was now anchored with a spring on her cable, everything seemed to be in order. Although so many of her hands were away in the boats, she was clearing for action. Her guns were run out already, and her old standing officers had the process well in hand. But in the fort, people were running hither and thither. There was a great deal of shouting, and the Indian gunners, whose officer was somewhere in the boats or perhaps on shore, were arguing passionately among themselves. Soldiers and sailors were at cross purposes, and even among the seamen there was none of that quiet, efficient cheerfulness that marked the actions Stephen had seen with Jack Aubrey. No impression of a machine moving smoothly into place. No food was served out, either. A small point, but one that Jack had always insisted upon. And the remaining boats, with at least 150 soldiers and seamen in them, were still a great way off. As far as he could make out, the launch had run aground on the horn of a bank, and since the tide was on the ebb, the others were having great difficulty hauling it off. In the fort and on the lagoon, time seemed to stagnate, in spite of the strenuous activity. Out at sea it flowed steadily, perhaps faster than its natural pace, and Stephen felt a large, ill-defined apprehension fill the back of his mind, like that which accompanies a nightmare. Now men could be distinguished aboard the ships. Now their faces were becoming visible, and orders came clear upon the wind. The French ships had formed a line to enter the channel, the Victor first, then the Minerve, then the Ceylon. The corvette steadied, hauled up her courses, and led in under topsails alone, the lead going out in the chains on either side. The noise in the fort had given place to dead silence, with the smell of slow match wafting on the breeze, drifting from the spare tubs and those beside each gun. The corvette entered the narrows, gliding nearer and nearer, her bell flashing in the sun. Came abreast of the fort, where the turbaned gunners crouched behind the parapet, and passed it, still in this dead silence. Her master's order to the helmsman brought her round in a tight curve behind the fort, into the deep water, and within 20 yards of the Nereide. The Nereide's French ensign came down, the English colours ran up with a cheer, and her side vanished in a great cloud of smoke as her broadside roared out in a single, vast, prolonged explosion. Another, and another, with incessant cheering. The corvette dropped her anchor under the Nereide's starboard quarter, still under her full traversing fire, and an officer ran aft along her shattered deck, calling out that she'd struck. At this point, the powerful Minerve was already in the channel, well within the channel, with the Ceylon close behind her. Now they were right under the heavy guns of the fort. They couldn't turn nor bear away nor move any faster. This was the deadly moment, and every man was poised for the order. At the flagstaff, the tricolour raced down to make place for the Union flag. But the cheering fool who hauled it down flung it wide onto a tub of burning match near the upper magazine. Flame leapt across, and with a crash far louder than a broadside and more blinding than the sun, 100 charges exploded all together. At the same second, the Bombay artillerymen, still without an officer to stop them overloading, set off their ill-pointed guns, bursting or dismounting 6 of them, and killing a man in the Nereide's gig as it was going to take possession of the Victor. Stephen picked himself up in the clearing smoke, realised that shrieks were piercing through his deafness, and hurried to the dead and wounded men scattered all about the flagstaff and the dismounted guns.
McAdam's assistant was there, and his loblolly boy. And with the help of a few clear-headed seamen, they carried them to the shelter of a rampart. By the time they'd done what little they could, dressing horrible burns with their torn-up shirts and handkerchiefs, the scene had changed. The Victor, having hoisted her colours again, had cut her cable, and she was following the Minerve and the Ceylon in towards port southeast. The Boulogne and Wyndham, just far enough out to sea, far enough from the Narrows to be able to turn, had hauled their wind. The French ships in the lagoon were standing straight for the narrow pass where the Nereid's other boats were advancing in a confused heap, and it seemed that they must take them in the next few minutes. The Minerve showed no obvious damage at all. Clomford hailed the fort from the Nereid, calling for all the soldiers to come aboard. He was going to attack the Minerve, and he needed every man to work his guns. It was not an impossible contest in spite of the Nereid's lighter metal. The Minerve was not yet cleared for action. She was approaching the second dogleg off the horseshoe bank where she couldn't turn, whereas the Nereid would still have room in the nearer anchorage to luff up and rake her, and neither the Victor nor the Ceylon could give her much support. But while the soldiers were in the act of going aboard, the Boulogne changed her mind. She let fall her topgallant sails and headed for the channel and the island. The moment she was engaged in the Narrows, there was no doubt of what she meant to do. She must come on. And she did come on with great determination. As she came, handled no doubt by a man who knew the passage perfectly, for she threw an extraordinary bow wave for such a dangerous piece of navigation, Stephen looked round to see what Clomfort was at, and to his astonishment he saw that the launch and the cutters were passing, had passed, the French men of war without being touched, had passed them in the Narrows within a biscuit toss. It was inexplicable. But in any case, there they were, with their men pouring into the Nereid and cheering as they came. The Nereid had not yet slipped her cables. The Boulogne stood on. She'd already cleared her starboard broadside, and as she approached the island, she fired her forward guns. The smoke, sweeping before her, veiled the fort, and through this veil she fired her full array as she swept by, sending 18-pound ball and countless lethal fragments of stone flying among the small remaining garrison. Swinging round into the Nereid's anchorage, she sent in another broadside against the other face of the battery. And to all this, the demoralised Bombay gunners, deprived of support from small arms men, unofficered, unused to ships, returned no more than a ragged, ineffectual fire. The Boulogne went straight for the Nereid as though to run her aboard. But just before they touched, the Boulogne put her helm hard down and shot by. For a moment, the two frigates were yardarm to yardarm, almost touching. Both broadsides crashed out together. And when the smoke cleared, the Boulogne was well beyond the Nereid, running on, still under her topgallantsails, for the second sharp turn in the channel, apparently undamaged. The Nereid had lost her driver boom in a couple of upper yards, but her turn and a sudden gust had laid the Boulogne over, so that her fire was too high to hurt the Nereid's hull or to kill many of her crew. It had cut the spring to her cable, however, and she slewed round so far and so fast that she couldn't fire into the Frenchman's stern. Now the silence fell again. The four French ships, for the Wyndham, shying at the entrance, and the fort had stood out along the channel, moved smoothly down to anchor in 20-fathom water off the Olive Bank, halfway to port southeast, and Clomfort returned to the island with a strong party of soldiers. He was in excellent spirits, hurrying about with the army officers to put the fort into such order that it could withstand an attack by the French squadron. Catching sight of Stephen, he called out, "How did you like that, Dr. Maturin? We have them in the bag!" A little later,
When the armourers had set up the dismounted guns and spare carronades had replaced those that had burst, he said, "If it hadn't been for that infernal luck with the flag, we should have sunk the Minerve. But it was just as well. The Boulogne would have hauled her wind, and as it is, we have both of them hard up in a clinch. I'm sending Weber in the launch to tell Pym that if he can spare me just one frigate, Iphigenia or Magicienne, if she's joined, I'll lead in and destroy the whole shooting match. We have them finely in the bag. They can never get out except on the land wind just before sunrise. How Cochrane will envious!"
Stephen looked at him.
Did Clomfort, in his euphoria or his leaping excitement, really believe that he'd done well, that his position was tenable? "You don't intend sailing away yourself in the Nereide to bring down the reinforcements, I collect," he said.
"Certainly not. Pym ordered me to hold this fort, and I shall hold it to the last. To the last," he repeated, throwing up his head with a look of pride. At the next word, his expression changed.
"And did you see that dog?" he cried. "The victor struck her colours to me and then hoisted them again and made off like a scrub. A contemptible, sneaking little goddamn scrub. I shall send a flag of truce to demand her. See where she lays."
She lay between the two heavy frigates, and from the fort her crew could be seen busily repairing the damage the Nereide had inflicted. The French colours flew at her peak.
"They're too close by far," said Clomfort.
He turned to the artillery officer, haggard and quite wretched at having been separated from his men, and having lost the finest opportunity of his professional career, and said,
"Captain Newnham, will the brass mortar fetch them, do you think?"
"I shall try it, my lord," said Newnham.
He loaded the piece himself with a 13-inch bombshell, laid it, a long and delicate operation, set the fuse just so, and fired. The shell soared high in the clean air, a rapidly diminishing black ball, and burst right over the Boulogne. A delighted cheer went up. The French ships slipped their cables and stood further in to anchor out of range. The last shell, fired at extreme elevation, fell short, and it was the last shot of the day. The remaining hours of light saw all the precautions taken that should have been taken the day before. By the next morning, the Ile de la Passe was capable of sinking any ship that attempted the passage. The Nereide had crossed new to gallant yards, had repaired her boom and fished her wounded foremast, and she sent in a boat to demand the surrender of the corvette.
"I hope to God Weber's found the Sirius," said Clomfort, gazing eagerly out to sea.
But the day passed, and no sail showed beyond the Cape. The night passed, too, with boats rowing guard. Before sunrise, the perilous land breeze began to blow. Perilous because it might bring the powerful ships and a swarm of boats across the lagoon in the darkness. But the French never stirred, and at dawn the reviving southeaster kept them where they lay. So 2 days went by, with no incident apart from the French commodore's refusal to give up the victor. The soldiers drilled and polished their equipment, the artillerymen exercised their pieces, the master gunner filled cartridge and checked his stores. Clonfert remained as cheerful and active as ever, and his spirits reached a new height on the third day, when the French ships were seen to move down to the far end of the harbour, right down among the shoals and under the batteries of Port Southeast, mooring in a curved line that stretched from one end of the sunken reef that guarded the port's entrance to the other. "For this," said he, "must mean that Weber had found the Sirius.
At least some of the blockading force must have disappeared from off Port Louis, and Governor Decamp, fearing an attack upon the Minerve and Bellone, had surely sent the news overland to Port Southeast. Clomfort was right. Some hours later, the Sirius herself rounded the Cape under a great press of sail. "Look sharp with the signal," said Clomfort, when they'd exchanged numbers. The prepared hoist broke out, and he laughed aloud. "What does it signify?" asked Stephen. "Ready for action, and enemy of inferior force," replied Clomfort with a slightly conscious look. And immediately afterwards, "Look alive with the McBriggs, what's she saying?" The signal yeoman muttered the answer, and the midshipman spoke up. "Send Nereid's master aboard, my lord." "Gig's crew," said Clomfort. "Mr. Satterley, bring her in as quick as ever you can." In she came, and her last signal before she entered the channel told the Nereid to get under way. The Sirius passed the fort almost as fast as the Bellone, and still under her topsails and courses, swept by the Nereid, Pym leaning over the rail and hailing Clomfort to follow him. Down the long winding channel they went, more cautiously now, but the Sirius still with her topsails set, for there wasn't much daylight left. In the Nereid, her black pilot was at the conn. He had her under staysails no more, and he was muttering to himself. For after the Horseshoe Bank, their course would lead them into a region of the inner harbour that they didn't know well, a region that they had avoided, it being swept by the guns of Port Southeast. Past the Noddy Shoal with the lead going fast, past the Three Brothers and a four-point turn to larboard. The leadsman's calls came sharp, quick and clear. "By the mark 10 and a half 10, by the deep 11, by the deep 11, by the mark 15. A good depth of water, a clear channel, one would have sworn. Yet at the last call, the Sirius, only just ahead, struck hard on the tail of a bank and ran far up onto the submerged coral. Yet, if she had to go aground, at least she'd chosen a good place for doing so. The shore batteries couldn't reach her, and the wind, blowing right onto the land, pinned the French frigates to their moorings. The Sirius and the Nereid carried out their warps undisturbed as the sun set over Mauritius, and they settled down to heaving her off in a seamanlike manner. But she wouldn't come off at the first heave, nor in the first hour of heaving, during which the tide began to ebb. However, tomorrow's flood would be higher, and there were great hopes of floating her at about 8 in the morning, and in the meantime there was nothing to be done except to ensure that no French boat attack could succeed. "What have you to say to our patient's present state of exaltation?" said Stephen to MacAdam. "In these circumstances, does it pass the limits of reasonable conduct? Do you find it morbid?" "I'm at a loss," said MacAdam. "I've never seen him like this at all. He may know what he's about, but he may be bent on wiping your friend's eye and damn the whole world so he does it. Have you ever seen a man look so beautiful?" Dawn. And still the French hadn't moved. For once no holy stone was heard aboard the Sirius or the Nereid. No swabs beat the decks, littered as they were with cables, hawsers, heavy tackles, all the resources of the boatswain's art. The tide rose, the capstans turned, slower and slower as the full strain came on, and as all hands who could find a place at the bars heaved her grinding off into deep water, where she anchored by the Nereid, and all the carpenters crowded about her bows, cut deep by the sharp and jagged coral. The exhausted hands were piped to their late breakfast, and they were beginning to set the still-encumbered deck into some kind of fighting trim when the Iphigenia and Magicienne were seen in the offing. Clomfort sent his master to bring them in, For Mr. Satterley, though harassed and ashamed, now certainly knew the channel up to this point very well. But he'd grown so cautious that it was not until after dinner that they dropped anchor and all captains gathered aboard the Sirius to hear Pym's plan of attack. It was clear. It made good plain sense. Nereide, with her black pilot, was to lead in an anchor between the Victor and the Bellone at the northern end of the French line. Sirius, with her 18-pounders, was to anchor abreast of the Bellone. Magicienne, between the Ceylon and the powerful Minerve. And Iphigenia, who also carried 18-pounders, abreast of the Minerve, closing the line on the south. The captains turned to their ships. Clomfort, who did, in fact, look extraordinarily gay, young and light-hearted, as though possessed by some happy spirit, went below to put on a new coat and fresh white breeches. Coming on deck again, he said to Stephen, with a particularly sweet and affectionate smile, "Dr. Maturin, I believe we may show you something to be compared to what you've seen with Commodore Aubrey." The Sirius made her signal, and the Nereide, slipping her cable, led in under staysails, her pilot conning the ship from the foretopmast yard. The Sirius followed her, then the Magicienne, then the Iphigenia, each falling into line at intervals of a cable's length. On through the winding channel with the steady breeze, the shore coming closer and closer. With successive turns in the channel, the intervals grew wider. And the Sirius, hurrying to close the gap and misjudging her swing, struck hard and grounded on the rocky edge. At the same moment, the French frigates and the shore batteries opened fire. Pym hailed his ships to carry on. In 5 minutes, the Nereide was out of the narrow pass. The Magicienne and the Iphigenia, judging the channel by the stranded Sirius, pressed on after her, but now at a somewhat greater distance. And in the last wind, 400 yards from the French line, the Magicienne took the ground. By now the French broadsides were sweeping high over the Nereide's deck from stem to stern to disable her as she ran down, making for the Victor's bow. "Warm work, Dr. Maturin," said Clonfert, and then, glancing over the taffrail, "Sirius hasn't backed off. She's hard and fast," he said. "We must tackle the Bellone for her. Mr. Satterley, lay me alongside the Bellone. Lay me alongside the Bellone," he said louder, to be heard above the din, for now the bow guns were answering the French. "Aye, aye, sir," said the master. For another cable's length she held on, straight through the French fire. Another 50 yards, and the master, waving his hand to the watchful boatswain, ordered the helm put up. The Nereide swung round, dropped her anchor, and lay there, broadside to broadside, abeam of the big Frenchman, and her 12-pounders roared out at point-blank range. She was firing fast. The marines and soldiers, packed tight on the quarter-deck and forecastle, were blazing away over the hammocks with steady pertinacity. Stray ropes and blocks fell onto the splinter-netting overhead. Smoke hung thick between the ships, continually renewed as it blew away, and through the smoke the Bellone's guns flashed orange. Flashes from the Victor, too, on the Nereide's starboard quarter. Stephen walked across to the other side. The Magicienne, hard aground on her sharp, piercing reef, with her figurehead pointing at the French line, could, nevertheless, bring her forward guns to bear, and she was hitting the enemy as hard as she could, while her boats worked furiously to get her off. The Iphigenia was close alongside the Minerve. They were separated by a long, narrow shoal, but they were not a stone's throw apart, and they were hammering one another with appalling ferocity. The volume of noise was greater than anything Stephen had ever experienced. Yet through it all there was a sound familiar to him, the cry of the wounded. The Bellone's heavy guns were mauling the Nereide most terribly, tearing gaps in her hammocks, dismounting guns. Presently she'd use grape. He was a little uncertain of his position. In all previous engagements his place as a surgeon had been below in the orlop. Here it was perhaps his duty to stand and be shot at, to stand with nothing to do like the army officers. It didn't move him unduly, he found, though by now Grape was screeching overhead. Yet, at the same time, men were carrying below in increasing numbers. And there at least he could be of some use.
I shall stay for the present, however, he reflected. It is something, after all, to view an action from such a vantage point. The glass turned, the bell rang, again and again. Six bells, he said, counting. Is it possible we've been at it so long?
And it seemed to him that the balloon was now firing with far less conviction, far less accuracy, that her ragged broadsides had far longer intervals between them. A confused cheering followed, and from the Iphigenia too. A gap in the cloud of smoke showed him the weakly manned and weakly armed salon, battered by the grounded magicienne and by the Iphigenia's quarter guns in the act of striking her colours. And in one of those strange momentary pauses without a gun, he heard the captain of the Iphigenia hail the magicienne in a voice of thunder, desiring her to take possession of the Indiaman. But as the magician's boat neared her, pulling fast through water whipped white with small shot and grate, the Salon dropped her topsails and ran for the shore behind the Boulogne. The boat was still pursuing her and roaring out when the Minerve, either cutting her cable or having it cut for her by the Iphigenia's murderous and continual fire, swung round, got under way, and ran straight before the wind, following the Salon. She steered better than the Salon, however, for the Indiaman blundered right into the Boulogne, forcing her too to cut. They all three drifted on shore, a heap of ships ashore, with the Minerve lying directly behind the Boulogne, and so near that she couldn't fire. But the Boulogne's broadside still lay square to the Nereide, and now men were pouring into her from the land and from the Minerve and the Salon. Her fire, which had slackened, now redoubled and grew more furious still, the broadsides now coming fast and true. The Iphigenia, directly to the windward of her shoal, and only a pistol shot from it, couldn't stir. And it was clear that in these last few minutes the face of the battle had totally changed. There was no more cheering aboard the Nereide. The gun crews, for all their spirit, were growing very tired, and the rate of fire fell off. By now the sun had almost gone, and the shore batteries, which had hitherto played on the Iphigenia and the Magicienne, now concentrated their fire on the Nereide. "Why do we swing so?" wondered Stephen. And then he realised that a shot had cut the spring on the Nereide's cable, the spring that held her broadside on to the Boulogne. Round she came, and farther yet, until her stern took the ground, thumping gently with the swell and pointing towards the enemy, who poured in a steady, raking fire. She still fired her quarter-guns and her stern-chaser, but now men were falling fast. The first lieutenant and three of the army officers were dead. Blood ran over her quarter-deck, not in streams, but in a sheet. Clonfert was giving the boatswain orders about a warp, when a messenger from below, a little terrified boy, ran up to him, pointing at Dr. Maturin as he spoke. Clonfert crossed the deck and said, "Dr. Maturin, may I beg you to give a hand in the all-up? McAdam has had an accident. I should be most infinitely obliged." McAdam's accident was an alcoholic coma, and his assistant, who had never been in action before, was completely overwhelmed. Stephen threw off his coat, and in the darkness, weakly lit by a lantern, he set to work. Tourniquet, saw, knife, sutures, forceps, probe, retractor, dressings. Case after case, with the sometimes perilously delicate operations continually interrupted by the huge, all-pervading, sonorous jar of heavy shots smashing into the frigate's hull, and still the wounded came, until it seemed that half
and even more than half of the Nereid's company had passed through his bloody hands as she lay there quite unsupported, her fire reduced to half a dozen guns. "Make a lane there! Make a lane for the captain!" he heard. And here was Clonfert on the chest before him under the lantern. One eye was torn out and dangling, maxilla shattered, neck ripped open and the carotid artery laid bare, pulsing in the dim light, its wall shaved almost to the bursting point. A typical splinter wound. And the frightful gash across his face was grape. He was conscious, perfectly clear in his mind, and at present he felt no pain. A far from uncommon phenomenon in wounds of this kind and at such a time. He wasn't even aware of the scalpel, probe and needle, except to say that they were oddly cold. And as Stephen worked over him, he spoke, sensibly, though in a voice altered by his shattered teeth. He told Stephen that he had sent to ask Pym whether he judged the ship could be towed out, or whether the wounded should be put into the squadron's boats and the Nereid set on fire. "She might wreck the Boulogne when she blows up," he added. His wounds were still being dressed when Weber came back from the Sirius with one of her officers and a message from Pym, a message that had to be shouted above the crash of the Boulogne's guns. Pym suggested that Clonfert should come aboard the Sirius. The Iphigenia couldn't possibly warp off from behind her shoal until daylight, and in the meantime the Nereid lay between her and the French ships. She couldn't fire upon them. Lord Clonfert might certainly come aboard the Sirius. "Abandon my men!" cried Clonfert in that strange new voice. "I'll see him damned first. Tell him I've struck!" And when the officer had gone and the dressing was finished, he said to Stephen, "Is it done, Doctor? I am most truly grateful to you," and made as though to rise. "You'll never get up?" asked Stephen. "Yes," he said. "My legs are sound enough. I'm going on deck. I must do this properly, not like a scrub." He stood up, and Stephen said, "Take care of the bandage on your neck. Do not pluck at it, or you may die within the minute." Shortly afterwards, most of the remaining men came below, sent by the captain. The routine of the ship was gone. There had been no bells this hour and more, and her life was going. Some clustered in the orlop, and from their low, muted talk, and from those who came and went, their shipmates learnt what was going on. A boat had come from the Iphigenia to ask why the Nereid was no longer firing and would the captain come aboard of her. Told had struck, and the captain would not stir. Captain had sent to Boulogne to tell her to stop firing, because why? Because he'd struck. But the boat couldn't reach her nor make her hear. Then there was the cry of fire on deck, and several men ran up to put it out, and shortly after the mainmast went by the board. Lord Clonfert came below again, and sat for a while in the orlop. Although Stephen was still working hard, he took a look at him between patients and formed the impression that he was in a state of walking unconsciousness. But after some time Clonfert got up and began moving about among the wounded, calling them by name. It was long past midnight. The French fire was slackening. The British fire had stopped long since. And now, after a few random shots, the night fell silent. Men slept where they had chanced to sit or throw themselves down. Stephen took Clonfert by the arm, guided him to the dead purser's cot well under the waterline, directed him how to rest his head so that he should not endanger his wound, and returned to his patients. There were more than 150 of them. 27 had already died below, but he had hopes for about 100 of the rest. The deer knew how many had been killed outright on deck and thrown overboard. 70 or so, he thought. He roused Mr. Fenton, who was sleeping with his head on his arms, leaning on the chest that formed their operating table, and together they looked to their dressings. They were still busy when the sun rose and the Bellone began to fire at the Nereide again. On and on, in spite of repeated hails. The gunner came below with a gushing splinter wound in his forearm, and while Stephen applied the tourniquet and tied the artery, the gunner told him that the Nereide's colours had not, in fact, been struck. They were flying still, and they couldn't be hauled down. There was a rumour that they'd been nailed to the mast, but the gunner knew nothing of it, and the boatswain, who would have had the true word, he was dead. "And not a scrap of rigging to come at them," he said. So his lordship's told the carpenter to cut the mizzen away. "Thank you kindly, sir. That's a right tidy job. I'm much obliged. And doctor," he said in a low rumble behind his hand, "if you don't much care for a French prison, there's some of us topping our boom in the cutter going aboard of Sirius." Stephen nodded, looked over his worst cases, and made his way through the wreckage to the cabin. Clonfert was not there. He found him on the quarterdeck, sitting on an upturned match tub and watching the carpenters ply their axes. The mizzenmast fell, carrying the colours with it, and the balloon's fire ceased. "There. I've done it properly," said Clonfert, in a barely intelligible murmur, out of the side of his ruined, bandaged face. Stephen looked at his most dangerous wound, found him sensible, though by now at a far remove, and said, "I wish to go to the Sirius, my lord. The remaining boat is fit to leave, and I beg you will give an order to that effect." "Make it so, Dr. Maturin," said Clonfert. "I wish you may get away. Thank you again." They shook hands. Stephen took some papers from his cabin, destroyed others, and made his way to the boat. It was no great climb down, for the Nereide had settled on the seabed. Although Pym received him kindly aboard the stranded Sirius, his conduct didn't raise Stephen's opinion of him as a commander or as a man of sense. The Iphigenia, having at last warped herself free of the long shoal that had stood between her and the Minerve, sent to ask permission to stand in, to attack the immobilized French ships, boarding them with extra hands from Sirius and Magicienne, and not only taking them, but rescuing the Nereide too. "No," said Pym, who needed her help to heave his own ship off, "she must go on warping towards the Sirius." Twice he sent back this categorical reply, each time as a direct order. With the Iphigenia warping out, the French fire concentrated on the Magicienne, hard and fast on her reef, badly holed, with 9 foot of water in her hold and only a few guns that could be brought to bear. The French shot poured in upon her, and sometimes upon the other ships, and upon the frantically busy, exhausted hands in the remaining boats all that long, appalling, bloody day. It was impossible to get her off. It was impossible that she should swim if she were got off. Her men were ordered into the Iphigenia, and after sunset she was set on fire, blowing up in doleful splendour about midnight. The next day the French had a new battery ready on shore, closer to, and the battery and the ships began to fire on the Iphigenia and the Sirius as they strove to heave Pym's frigate off her reef. At last, after incessant labour all in vain, and after some ugly scenes with the captain of the Iphigenia, who was utterly convinced, And Stephen, together with many better qualified observers, agreed with him that his plan would have meant a total victory, and who could barely bring himself to speak civilly to the man who had forbidden it, Pym realized that the Sirius could not be saved. Her ship's company were taken into the Iphigenia, and the Sirius too was set on fire. Pym, thereby relinquishing his command 24 hours too late, and the now solitary Iphigenia returned to her warping. She was obliged to warp, to carry out an anchor on the end of a cable, drop it, and wind herself up to it by the capstan, because never in the daylight did the wind cease blowing dead on shore. She could make no progress whatsoever in any other way, for when the land breeze got up before dawn, she dared not attempt the dark and unseen channel, and it always died with the rising of the sun. So hour after hour her boats, carrying the ponderous great anchors, dragged out the sodden 9-inch hawsers, and if the anchors held, if the ground was not foul, she then crept a very little way, rarely more than 50 yards, because of the turns. But often the ground was foul, and sometimes the anchors came home, or were broken, or were lost altogether. And all this exhausting labour had to be carried out in the blazing sun by a dispirited crew. Meanwhile, the French ships in Port Southeast had been heaved off, and a French brig was sighted beyond the Ile de la Passe, probably the forerunner of Armelin's squadron from Port-Louis. However, there was nothing for it, and the Iphigenia warped on and on towards the fort, 50 yards by 50 yards, with long pauses for the recovery of fouled anchors, the whole length of that vast lagoon. It was 2 full days before she reached a point about 3/4 of a mile from the island, and here she anchored for the night. The next day, when the Bellone and the Minerve had profited by the land breeze to advance fair into the lagoon whose channels they knew so well, and had there anchored, she set to again. And by 8 o'clock, when she was within 1,000 feet of the fort, of the open sea, and the infinite delight of sailing free, she saw 3 ships join the French brig outside the reef: the Venus, Manche, and Astre. They were exchanging signals with the Bellone and the Minerve, and the wind, still right in the Iphigenia's teeth, was bearing them fast towards the Ile de la Passe, where they would lie to just out of range. The Iphigenia at once sent the soldiers and many of the seamen to the fort and cleared for action. She had little ammunition, however. Even before the end of the Port Southeast battle, she'd had to send to the Sirius for more, and since then she'd fired away so much that 30 minutes' engagement would see her locker bare. The clearing was therefore largely symbolic, and it was carried out, as her captain told Stephen privately, to let the French see that he would not surrender unconditionally, that he still had teeth, and that if he couldn't get decent terms, he would use them. "That being so," said Stephen, "I must ask you for a sailing boat before the Venus and her consorts close the entrance to the channel." "For reunion, you mean?" "Yes, certainly. You shall have the launch and my own coxswain, an old whaling hand, and young Craddock to navigator. Though I shouldn't carry the news that you must take, no. Not for £1,000. He gave orders for the preparation of the launch: stores, instruments, charts, water. And returning, he said, "You would oblige me extremely, Dr. Maturin, by carrying a letter for my wife. I doubt I shall see her again this war." The launch pulled along the wicked channel in the darkness, touching twice for all their care, pulled out well beyond the reef, set her lugsail and bore away southwest. She carried 10 days' provisions, but although she had many of the Iphigenia's hungry young gentlemen and ship's boys aboard, Their captain couldn't see them spend those years in a prison. The stores were almost intact when, after a perfect voyage, Stephen made his laborious way up the Boadicea's side as she lay at single anchor in the road of St. Paul's, close by the Wyndham and the Bombay transport.
"Why, Stephen, there you are!" cried Jack, springing from behind a mass of papers as Stephen walked into the cabin. "How happy I am to see you! Another couple of hours and I should have been off to Flat Island with Keating and his men."
"Stephen, what's amiss?"
"I must tell you what's amiss, my dear," said Stephen.
But he sat down and paused a while before going on.
"The attack on Port Southeast has failed. The Nereid is taken. The Sirius and the Magician are burnt. And by now the Iphigenia and the Ile de la Paz will almost certainly have surrendered."
"Well," said Jack, considering,
"Minerve, Bellone, Astrée, Venus, Manche, together with Nereid and Iphigenia, that makes 7-1.
But we've seen longer odds, I believe.